You're listening to the Thank God for Nostra podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Thank God for Nostra podcast. My name is Jordan Bush. I'm the executive director of TGFB Media.
And my name is John, a.k.a. Hoddlebot. I do the Coracle and Flotilla Nostra clients. And today we are doing another book group. We have just read Nicholas Carr's Superbloom, subtitled How Technologies of Connection Tear Us Apart. So as usual, it's another, potentially a downer of a story, although he wraps it up pretty well at the end, I think. Before we jump into it, though, let's read our verse for today. It's Luke 24:39. Jesus says, "Look at my hands and my feet. It is I myself. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see I have."
For some of you may be thinking to yourself, what on earth does that a reference to? That seems like the most random verse ever. So John, why don't you unpack that for us?
Yeah, well, I picked this one because the incarnation of Jesus is the central event of all of history. The second most consequential event in history is the incarnation of us in creation. God started the whole thing by speaking it all into existence, and then he sent his word, Jesus, the Logos, into the world to save us. He saved us in a legal way, but also in a relational way. He's given us treasure. He's given us family. He saved us in all these different dimensions, and all of those things converge in the person of Jesus. And as we'll see, I think Nicholas Carr makes a pretty incarnation-centric argument at the end of his book. It's not explicitly Christian, but I think it's very consistent with that vision of Christ as the incarnated Lord, who's Lord of not only heaven, but also of earth. So, good. I think it's a good place to center our conversation around.
Yeah. So again, what were your thoughts, your initial thoughts, initial takeaways, surface level from reading this book compared to the other, The Shallows that we read by Carr and some of the other books on the place and role of technology that we've read?
Yeah, well, I think it was, I really enjoyed it. It's very readable. He's a great author. Comparing it to The Shallows, I think The Shallows was more revealing to me. Maybe it's because I read it 2 years ago almost, but and this was more kind of treading a lot of ground that has already been covered in a lot of ways. But I really like how he encapsulated it and some of the juxtapositions he draws between older technology, older communications technology, and current digital media. He's also very balanced. He's not like a doomer about everything. He doesn't have all the answers, but he does have a framework that he presents at the very end, which is helpful. Unlike Anton Barbaquet, who incidentally he credits in his acknowledgments as someone who read an early draft of this book.
Okay.
And you can definitely see the similarity in their thinking, and that there is a relationship and rapport there. So I felt like it was a better organized, more concise version of a web of our own making in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think one of the things that just perpetually comes back to me, and that I just think about is, again, what is the evaluative framework that these guys are using? And like again, the reality is like everyone has a framework, whether it's acknowledged or not, and that framework is, more or lesser. It's true to a lesser or greater degree, and I say true because it has to correspond with what it means to be human. And we've talked about this a lot. So much of like, Nicholas Carr is going to talk about like some of the things that he's going to make statements that are, truth claimy. they're like, he's pushing on something he knows is real. But again, as we talk about right up until like the very end, he doesn't necessarily, right through the end, like he doesn't have like, he won't acknowledge, what is forming the framework that's allowing him to criticize, to do it. And so I think these things, all of these books you've read, they kind of fall short because of that, because of a lack of a real grounding for the criticism that they're making. It's just kind of, we'll get into some specifics, but I don't know. Yeah, that's kind of,
it's an interesting trade-off, because, like, you know, if he did try to anchor his arguments in epistemology, it would make the book longer, less accessible, and people would probably have more to argue with. So by keeping himself out of the book, he creates something that, you know, anyone can pick up and read. And, you know, I think one of the strengths of Carr's writing is how based in scientific studies it is. He understands science too. He doesn't just cite studies that agree with his position. He looks at them really critically. And I find that much more interesting than how people usually use science, and really, really helpful.
I think I also appreciated just the historical, you know, context, like him looking at previous technological advances and measuring them again. I think it's just, it's real easy to live in the moment, you know, and that's like the charitable way to put it, which is just, I'm going to live as if the past never happened, and as if there's nothing that's happened to this point that could remotely be comparable to what we're experiencing. And so that's just such a shallow and, you know, it's just a ridiculous way to live, is to act like, you know, we are the pinnacle of all history, and there's nothing that we can learn about, you know, technology, nothing that humanity has experienced can shed any light on what to do, you know, with what's happened before. And so his willingness to acknowledge his forefathers in a real sense, you know, acknowledge people who've lived before and previous things as a point of comparison and somewhere we can have a historical anchoring point to. I really appreciated that in a world that just increasingly, because of some of the constraints that you mentioned, like one of the things, this is a pet peeve as somebody who is now in the publishing business. It's just perpetually, you know, you'd love to believe that every book that goes out there is just, you know, somebody, they're like, I don't want to write this unless I absolutely have to. And it's just not true. And in a, I won't write this until it's done. And it, you know, absolutely, it was done to communicate things in the best possible way. It's like, no, the reality is, like, there's constraints on people's time. You know, the amount of, you know, people, if you work on a book for 2 years and it still isn't out yet, you know, you're looking at, is it possible to generate a return on these things? And so, you know, from a monetary standpoint. And so in a lot of ways, there's a lot more constraints to good books preventing good, you know, the best books from being written than you would otherwise have. And again, that's okay to a degree, but it's something to take into account. You know, there's books that, like, really probably what should happen is that Nicholas Carr should wait. He should have waited, you know, he should have waited, or, you know, it would be a better book if he would have waited until maybe the end of his life or something, where he's kind of reached more settled opinions.
Well, the liar is, I feel like he has, because, you know, The Shallows was, that was 17 years ago. So he's been thinking about this stuff for that period of time.
Correct.
And like you're saying about the historical context, like his historical literacy is pretty amazing. I don't know how you get to that point. I mean, you just got to do the reading and the research.
Well, that's the thing. There is no shortcut. Like in reality, like there's no shortcut, whether you're doing, you know, whether you're thinking and processing these things out yourself, or you're reading other people's processed thoughts and then processing those, you know, their thinking, there's no shortcut to this. And so again, even in the realm of chat, you know, the day of ChatGPT, which he kind of gets into, which we'll talk about. And, you know, a lot of these things, people are looking for shortcuts. And I just don't think there are shortcuts to anywhere near the same degree that a lot of that ChatGPT would want to present itself as. There's just unexamined assertions that are going to be happening everywhere. And so I think that having somebody, like the fact that Nicholas has been thinking about this for so long does lend me, it makes me want to, you know, makes me value his thinking more than it would somebody who's just some random, you know, new person who just had some cool insights and decided to write a book. But anyhow, where'd you initially want to start here, John?
Well, I think we could probably describe the three stages of the book and
sure,
what he's trying to do in each one. So part one is collapse. Part two is the tragedy of communication. And part three is everything is mediated. So collapse is kind of, you know, he's talking about the collapse of the analog communications infrastructure, mostly focusing on radio and television and that kind of thing to a lesser extent. But he spends a lot of time talking about radio and how digital media comes in and sort of takes a wrecking ball to that entire world.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of policy sort of stances that are developed over the course of the 20th century with radio. And they, his complaint later on in the book is that those policies weren't really adapted to the internet because there was so much enthusiasm for the open web in the 90s. And he says, you know, the time to shape the development of the internet through policy has sort of passed. We missed the boat. And we should try to enumerate some of those things, but really quickly, part two, tragedy of communication, is kind of like where we currently are. So, you know, what is the state of our way of communicating, and its impact on the political world and on our personal world, what the fallacies are involved with that. And then part three, everything is mediated. He gets into AI a little bit, which, as usual, the AI chapter is kind of like the least interesting one to me. And I was thinking about why that is. I think, you know, with Marshall McLuhan, he kind of says that we don't understand what something is until it's already happened.
Yep.
Or it's very hard to anticipate. So there's a bunch of obvious things that everyone sort of anticipates about AI, but what actually is going to happen is going to be much more complex and much more interesting. And we're just like, we're not really there yet. Yes, we should try to anticipate things and be thoughtful about it, but it's going to change us in ways that we don't recognize. And I think to Carr's credit, he recognizes that at the end of that chapter too. He's like, yeah, this is going to shape us, and we have no idea what all these different new capabilities are going to do. And then he ends with Dr. Johnson's Rock, which is, I thought, a fantastic chapter, but we can save that for the end.
Mm. Yep. So we've got the collapse, tragedy of communication, part two, part three, everything is mediated. He's going to, you know, kind of look at these things, look at technology, and you know, just unpack a lot of these things. Now, again, what was your overall, you said you appreciated the book?
Yeah. I definitely recommend it. It's an easy read compared to some of the books that we've read.
Yeah.
It's definitely popular level and just as substantial, I would say.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, I'm looking at the Kindle version. It's like 260 pages. Do you have the physical copy there with you?
Yeah, mine's 230.
230. Okay. Yeah.
Pretty light book.
All right. Well, let's get into what were some of the things that you took away?
Yeah, well, one thing I liked about the way he wrote the book was he kind of centers a lot of the content around individual historical figures. So he talks about this guy named Cooley, who died in 1929. So he wrote, he actually coined the term social media in the late 1800s. And he compares him to Marshall McLuhan. He says that Cooley's emphasis was different from McLuhan's. McLuhan was primarily interested in how communication technologies mold individual consciousness by altering sense perceptions and patterns of cognition. Cooley's interest lay in how the technologies shape the social mind by changing the way influence flows and associations form among people. Mm-hmm. So he's more focused on the group, and McLuhan is more focused on the individual. Mm-hmm. And there's some interesting results of that. He was much more, he was a huge visionary in a lot of ways, way, way before his time. You know, he's writing when the telegraph is coming into popularity. And his basic argument, if I can try to summarize it, is, you know, reflected in the title of the chapter, a more perfect liquefaction. By hastening the spread of knowledge, you fuel individualism. But the result of this, and this is something that James Poulos talks about in Human Forever, is kind of the creation of this swarm and the sort of leveling of differences. Let's see. He says, there are as many social media as there are specialized groups of sympathetic and communicating individuals. And in choosing his environment, a man chooses what groups he will belong to. Each of these groups or media is subject to movements more or less peculiar to itself. It has, in some measure, its own opinions, institutions, and traditions. And so, you know, thinking about groups, an individual gets merged into the group, but the group actually is a medium in itself. So media is not just the stuff that we use to communicate. We ourselves are vessels of communication.
Yeah. Yeah. Him talking, he starts talking about just the telegraph. And again, I just had never thought about the disruptive nature of the telegraph and how like it's negatively impacted, where like initially, you have like the military has it. I think it was military or radio. I think it's something, he starts talking about these different things, and he talks about how, like at one point they initially, it was just a small limited group of people who have these telegraph machines and then have these radios. And then over time, as more and more people get them, they start doing all kinds of ridiculous things. And so it's just, like, it ends up causing problems both for, for people involved in war and people involved in different aspects of these things. It just was fascinating because, again, it's so easy to look back at history and you just assume that, they're all these staid, serious people. And then like, these are like the, these are like the I can't think of a non-offensive, other than like, it's just like shit posting back in the day. These guys are just sending telegraphs, funny telegraphs or like sending these weird radio things, just messing with people. You just think that the technology is going to heal everything. And then so much of what was said about the telegraph and then what was said about radio, as like, there's people who are saying a lot of the same things that are said about like AI. And I was thinking about Bitcoin, where I can't remember if it was the telegraph or radio, where it said like, it's going to cause wars to cease. It's going to cause all these different, like there was all these predictions about, what the effect that these, these technologies were going to have. And I was going to be just, pretty utopian and all of these things. And yet time after time, that actually resulted in the exact opposite, things got worse over time.
He kind of points to Cooley as a microcosm of his entire argument.
Yeah.
And a lot of the fallacies that a lot of people take for granted, or most people take for granted when talking about the internet. He gets into it more in his chapter on democratization, the fallacy of democratization. Mm-hmm. But like Cooley says, it is the tendency of communication to give human nature a fair chance. Mm-hmm. We can create a more perfect society by getting people to communicate more. People sharing more creates a more open culture and leads to a better understanding of the lives and perspectives of others. And, that's reflected in the truism of more speech, better speech is more speech. So the more that we can communicate with other people, the more we'll understand people. Carr gets into this. It's a running theme in the book, but his basic argument is that human beings are not computers. Society does not scale.
Yeah.
He gets later on, he talks about how, these studies have been done in sociology and psychology, where the more you know about a person, the more likely you're going to dislike them, which is not what most people believe. We think that all you need to do to learn to love your neighbor is to get to know them.
Yeah.
But as it turns out, our preferences, our dislike preferences cascade more quickly than our like preferences. If we find out something negative about a person, it ruins a lot of the positive things that we thought about them and makes us more likely to think negatively about them. So when we're in constant communication with more and more people, with more and more transparency and more frequency, the result is outgroup cascades. And so he points to like, especially political polarization, where, it used to be that people could have a rational conversation and understand each other and actually come to some kind of agreement or compromise. But that's becoming less and less possible, because not only do we live in separate epistemic worlds, the epistemic worlds that we live in politically are downstream of those preference cascades, where it's like, yeah, this guy's on the other team and I don't like him for this, 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 and this reason. All of which are completely valid in your own mind.
Yeah. Yeah. He was talking about, the idea of like, what you just described is the idea of like familiarity, breeds contempt. You want to believe that, greater knowledge brings greater unity, and it's reality. The reality is quite different. And again, the question is, why is that? It's because there's something fundamentally, at issue with humans, where we have this bent towards ourselves as individuals, that conflicts with just the goal that everyone would acknowledge of like loving your neighbor. You know, like we understand the goodness of the idea, but in practice it's far more difficult. I think it was interesting to hear the part of chapter one where he talks about the gift. And he brings up our favorite book here. He says, you know, the cosmos, the opening verses of the Bible tells us was spoken into being. You know, the original act of creation was an act of communication. And then he talks about, I think throughout this chapter as well, just like some of the limiting factors, you know, of communication throughout time. So like if you live in a world where the only form of communication that's possible is actual speech, then, you know, there's a limit to how many people you can speak to, how much you can say, you know, how far of a distance you can say it over. And then as technology grows, you know, the speed at which you can, you know, like if with a telegram, you know, you can send a message over a certain, you know, over a certain distance faster. But again, even there's still limitations of the speed, limitations of how much can be said, that, you know, carrying capacity issues. And same thing with radio. And like a lot of these things, they can be overcome via advances in technology. Like this is what happened with radio. This is what happened with, you know, the internet, like your bandwidth grows and all this kind of stuff. But again, just like this idea of being fashioned in God's image, he talks about, and he basically makes the claim that to be fashioned in God's image is to share his ability to speak. And so what it ought to make us, you know, question is like, you know, God created us with a certain capacity. And, you know, I think that it's instructive. Like God's design is in itself instructive. And so the ability to communicate endlessly or to communicate at endless speed over endless distance, you know, this, we ought to question and be willing to question if that, you know, the value of that, or, you know, it, obviously there's some value. We can all recognize some value, but that if we don't recognize the cost associated with that ability as well, we're going to find ourselves in a situation, hey, like the one we're in.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. The comparison to the history of radio, I thought was really instructive. There are a lot of really interesting parallels. Like he mentions how a lot of the people who pioneered radio technology were tinkerers and hackers, yeah, basically, you know.
Yep.
So here we are repeating the history of radio, which was largely unregulated at the time. Mm-hmm. And then when the Titanic sank, all hell broke loose because all the airwaves were full of fake news and just noise, so that people who needed to communicate with each other couldn't communicate with each other. He says there's a case to be made that more people died and in the Titanic because than was necessary because the airwaves were all clogged. But like all of that history led to a couple of important doctrines in policy world. Well, I mean, one is the right to privacy and correspondence, which is a very, very old thing. Like you can't read people's mail.
Yep.
And that has actually been thrown out in the digital world as we've opted into, you know, various solutions that do not respect our privacy and don't have a responsibility to respect our privacy. Mm. But then there's also the fairness doctrine. It would probably be helpful to actually define the fairness doctrine. So let me just like look this up really quick. It was a policy that required the holders of broadcast licenses both to present controversial issues of public importance and to do so in a manner that fairly reflected differing viewpoints. So it's kind of one of those very policy-like things that's like, here's what we want to happen, and we're just going to say that it happens, and then, you know, we'll go with that. And obviously, you know, he goes through the 50 years of history of the Fairness Doctrine and all the problems that arose and were addressed and stuff like that. But he says that the basic principle is an ethical principle, and the idea is that it ensures people's right to have a say in the workings of the institutions and systems that shape their lives, which is a right fundamental to a true democracy and a just society. And so, you know, where this gets reflected with digital technology is in the democratization aspect of the internet, right? If we're able to participate in it, if we're able to make our, you know, broadcast our voices, then we have agency in our, you know, in our political system,
yeah,
in the powers that govern our lives. But then he goes on to talk about mass media and tyranny. So in like Nazi Germany and in Soviet Union, the tyrants in those countries used radio to broadcast, but but there was no feedback loop. What the audience wanted didn't matter. And so we find ourselves in a similar situation where we have mass media. And yes, we can still say whatever we want, but our voices are not really reflected in that, you know, torrent of content.
Yeah. And again, this is where, I mean, I'm like just thinking about the role of algorithms, you know, because like there still are just normal people who get posts to go viral. Like they say something and it still, you know, gets out. Like the algorithm latches onto it. And, you know, again, I don't know. I'm conflicted. We need to do like a whole episode on algorithms and like have like the arguments for and against, because, you know, it's a tricky.
He touches on some of that stuff too. Like, you know, there's some research on retweets, and fake information, false information tends to get retweeted more than true information.
Yeah.
Which is like, I mean, it just goes to his thesis of like, what's broken is not the technology or the policy. What's broken is human nature. And human nature is really what needs to be restrained. And technology has opened up a road for human nature to become what it has always been wanting to do. He compares humans to, you know, rats pulling a lever to stimulate their pleasure centers in their brain.
Sure.
And like if that's all we are, then that's where we're going to go.
It is tricky though, right? Because like, I mean, there's 100 wrong ways to do something and only one, you know, there might be 100 wrong ways to do something and only one or, you know, one right way or something. And so like, obviously it shouldn't surprise us that there'd be more, you know, misinformation than there would be. I mean, again, like there's more, again, from like a religious standpoint, there's more wrong religions than there are, than there are true ones. You know, there's more more advocates of false religious views than there are real ones.
But the truth is always pretty boring, you know?
Yeah. Like, well, I think that's getting at part of the issue is like the problem is the incentives for going fast are so much greater than the incentives to go slow So like the incentives we talked about how, I can't remember what it was, but like you look at something like Facebook, okay? They're incentivized to not think about, well, what are the possible negative things here? Like, you know, they could have sat around for years and thought out these things and, you know, thought about the consequences. They could have waited to make decisions. And then once they had a well-developed idea of whether this would be good or not, they could have advanced. But that's not how you make lots of money.
Yeah,
and that's not how you get powerful, you know, is by, you know, thinking through these things. Because what if at the end of the day, it turns out this actually is going to be horribly destructive to do these things? Well, then you've just said no to trillions of, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars you could have made in the short term.
And that happens throughout history. You know, like you look at the story of Teflon and they're like, yeah, you know what? It makes pregnant women have cancerous babies. But we're just going to go ahead and do it anyway and suppress the research. I think Facebook, in comparison with a lot of these scandals throughout history, has been very ethical in how it's managed things. They actually do hire all the technological ethicists and they ask them what they think, and they change their policies and technologies based on the feedback from the ethicists. They also fire the ethicists and often decided that, you know, we can't drop this thing because it's essential to the business. So like there is both going on there. It's just a very hard thing to do the right thing when there are pressures and incentives pushing you in the wrong direction. And you also have a failure of understanding too. Like, you know, going back to that epistemic foundation, like you just don't have, if you don't have a robust understanding of human nature, you can't make good choices about it, especially when you're coming at it from a frame that is based on efficiency and on profit. So,
And in saying you can't make good choices, what you're saying is you're going to make shorter sighted. Because again, all of this comes down to time horizon. Like the ability to have unlimited internet is great if you're in an emergency. You know, like the ability to communicate with people anywhere on earth is incredible given certain parameters. Like there's, again, this is, we were just talking about this with CR, with Pastor CR Wiley yesterday, which is like how, like the temptation is to argue from the exception, like use the exception to create a rule. And so you're like, well, like, look, there's, we were talking about within the context of families and stuff. And about how, like, you know, people can look down on something like the patriarchy, like, oh, look, you know, there's fathers who've, you know, abused their children or, you know, abused their wives. And you're like, okay, yes, obviously, yes, that does happen in a very, you know, limited capacity relative to all of the people out there who are just normal, totally normal families with, you know, fathers who are working hard, taking care of their, you know, taking care of their kids. But again, it's easy to make emotional arguments that are short-sighted, that account for real but limited sample data, and then basically make policies on the back of that. And so I think that's another part of this is, it's easy to, you know, for Facebook to make the, you know, again, I'm just using them as an example, like for them to like, hey, look, here's the best case scenario, the best case scenario for what you can do with Facebook. Here's, you know, this is the advantages. It's connecting people. It's, you know, doing all these things. And I guess the example he talked about was he basically gave there's five, he did this whole like tweet thread about poverty pimpers or poverty pimping. And it's basically it was in relation to the USAID, you know, scandal, and about how there's all these nonprofit organizations that just thrive off of never solving the problems that they're created to, that they're paid and given money to solve, because if they did, then they'd be out of business. And he talked about how there's like five groups of people within those worlds. And the smallest group is the, he called them the saints, which is basically the sweet people who actually are solving problems and who are actually, you know, they really do care about people. And so what happens is the other four groups who, you know, they're not actually solving the problems, and in many cases, they're nefarious actors. They all claim to be the saints. And they all make arguments for why their services are needed as if they were all saints. And so they argue from the exception, and they say, well, because of that, you need to give us all this money. We need to get all this money. And so I think the same thing, it's easy for the same thing to happen, you know, here is it's easy for us to, and for, you know, businesses who really do at the end of the day, they might have some people who actually care about solving these problems, but the underlying denominator for success for the overwhelming majority of these businesses, if not in the beginning, within a very short order, is just to make money. They're denominating success and, you know, can we make money at this? And they're willing to push past barriers because they can make so much money by creating some of these tools. And so, again, you mentioned Teflon. That's one example. You could go through 100 examples, of either doing something and pushing past, you know, things that would be reasons to stop, or not doing things that would actually be reasons to do them, because of the love of money, which, you know, we could have used that as our verse for today.
And of course, like, people do these things and make these exceptions because they have a framework and a mission that, it causes them to, compromise their integrity in a lot of ways. Like, you know, and, sometimes on purpose, sometimes on accident. One of my favorite chapters in this book was the democratization fallacy. I thought it was very good. You know, Mark Zuckerberg says a lot of the right things about connecting people and cultivating communities and stuff, and then all of his actions do exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
And he cites John Dewey a couple of times in here, which is, I think, a really illuminating comparison. John Dewey was all about creating a, quote, great community founded on a free and open system of communication that enables an organized, articulate public to come into being. So it was John Dewey, the great, you know, Dewey logical organizer of society in the early 1900s, where a lot of this ethos came from. I think I see that, well, The value of democracy and democratization is very interesting because it is very much how we have ended up where we are, the democratization that the internet led to. And, you know, Carr also links it with authoritarianism. If you have an extreme level of democratization, you end up with a charismatic, personality-centered mode of authoritarianism emerging. And so we're really just dealing with the consequences of our own values. And it's funny, you know, back to the more speech, better speech is more speech idea. A lot of the ethos of Noster is democratizing, where we say, okay, you know, the problem is censorship. The problem is authoritarianism. So to fight authoritarianism, we are going to do more speech, more better self-authenticating speech. That fact of history, that cycle, really bothers me. Now, I'm not sure that there is much of an alternative than to go through that cycle in a lot of ways. And I think Noster offers some very interesting benefits in terms of digital signatures to where, you know, because so, you know, Carr talks a lot about human nature and how it drives us off the cliff by allowing us to stimulate ourselves and fulfill our baser desires for, you know, avoidance of embarrassment and decoupling from difficult things. But humans are not just rats. You know, we also have the image of God. We have reason and we have values. Hopefully to some extent, I mean, they can be highly obscured by sin and by circumstance. But you know, what we have in the current internet is the emergence of our baser desires enshrined into structures that keep us there and deprive us of our agency of doing anything better. In one of these chapters, he ends it by saying, it's easy to get into the digital world. It's very hard to leave it. Even if you turn off even if you throw your phone away, delete all your accounts, all your friends are there now. And so you can't actually return to the real world because the real world disappeared while you were absent from it. But, you know, what Noster potentially does is by allowing people to issue their own credentials, basically. It allows us to choose, it gives us credible exit, right? Yeah. If there is something, and this is a revealed preference, just as much as it's a revealed preference to watch a lot of stimulating content. You know, there is a market for extensions to browsers that will block you from looking at certain sites at certain times of the day so that you can actually focus and get your work done. There's grayscale modes built into Android and Apple devices already. So like it's a fairly mainstream thing to want to opt out of these things, but we can't fully opt out because a lot of our attention is actually captured by the value that the platforms provide. So, you know, I think it's really important to take seriously the democratization fallacy, because I think I personally commit this all the time. Yeah. But at the same time, there is value to giving individual people agency to.
Yeah. What's an example of like where you've experienced, like, you're like, this is a fallacy of democratization, like this, you know, something within, whether it's Coracle or just some other capacity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the idea is that if you empower people to make their own choices, they will make choices in their own interest, and they will make poor choices because people are emotional and not, you know, not scientific. And to that extent, like, that's fine. But it also means, you know, Carr kind of points to this grouping of ourselves, self-categorization, you know, kind of. So, you know, he talks a lot about the externalization of the self. So in the real world, we have to be ourselves when we're by ourselves. But in the digital world, we end up having to be ourselves by virtue of displaying ourselves. That's not exactly getting at the question, but I mean, just in my own personal life, we talked last month about my podcast fast, you know. That's a thing where I've been given all this power and all this information, and I choose to just not be present with my family. And that's not exactly the democratization fallacy. It's more, I think where that comes in is how it splits people into groups. So, you know, I had a conversation with some people at the liberal coffee shop a couple weeks ago that I just keep thinking about. And they were saying absurd things. They were comparing conservatives to Stalin, and say, he was like, Stalin's a conservative. And I had to turn around and be like, look, man, you are making the most absurd equivocation ever. And that's a cartoonish equivocation, but we all do it in all kinds of ways.
Yeah.
To other person. And, you know, even people who value centrism and neutrality do that because that is the democratization fallacy. The idea that there is a view from nowhere, and that you can actually be neutral. That's a bizarre, untenable position in itself. So the solution is not to try to strive for some impossible neutral position, because it's always relative to what's on either side of it. I don't know, I would hesitate to say the solution, but what Carr points out is that the acceleration of communication and the externalization of self-categorization exacerbate that problem, where we become more and more members of abstract categorized groups rather than individual people with like a rich internal life. And because of that, we begin to abstract ourselves. We see ourselves that way. And so when someone attacks our abstraction of ourself, then they're attacking us. Whereas, you know, it is possible to separate yourself from your opinions. It's okay to change your mind. But I think I see a lot of the same things are very possible with Nostr. Nostr does not fix human nature. And the speed of communication, a lot of the dark patterns, like he talks about the feed a lot, which I think is really good. Those are all present in Nostr as well. And so,
does he talk about where the word, I mean, like, I never thought of this until right now, but like, so your feed, okay, makes me think of like a trough. Okay, this is where you go. So again, it's within the consumer. Like it's like you are a consumer. Here's your feed. You know, this is the animal farm. You're the pig. You're showing up to consume this stuff. Like all of this is, it's a very particular anthropological view of the nature of what it means. Yeah, it's the nature of what it means to be human. That's what anthropology.
Yeah,
like yeah, it's absolutely. Just really fascinating how like these, like they're saying this, and like, everyone has a view of what it means to be human. You have, whether you have fleshed it out really well and thought about it a lot or not, everyone, like your view, you have a view of reality that it is grounded in something, and it influences every single thing you do. And one of the quotes that most impacted me was in the, it's in the very last chapter, I think. He talks about, he says, society shapes itself to the system rather than the other way around. And I think that one of the things that I know I feel is just like, I mean, I'm working in this industry, Bitcoin. My goal, you know, part of my job is like to help, it's to educate. And so I have to be out there. And yet, like, where you're out there in a world where like there is no restraints. Like I could literally, I could tweet 24 hours a day. I could, you know, say, I could record for probably, I mean, if I pressed, I could probably do 17 hours a day. They're so open-ended, and there's not a lot of saying no. Like everything is designed to say yes to you. You know, you are being presented as if you are the god of the system. Everything is being done to please you, at least superficially. With most internet, you just can't choose. Like the model of monetization of these networks is via advertising, and that's you can't opt out of that. You can't select out of that. And so I think that, you know, it is difficult. Another example of this would be you had in many places in the United States, you had like there were Sabbaths, like there were just built in that were built into these towns and counties. Like you had, you know, we would rest on either Saturday or Sunday. Like that just was. And so that would mean government buildings were shut down. That would mean post offices shut down. A lot of these things, there was structure built into these societies. And now like it's still like since we've been back from Uruguay, it's been wild because like, you can still get delivered, you know, deliveries on Sunday now. Like that didn't happen to anyone near the same degree, you know, 15 years ago as it does now. And again, it's because of some of these, you know, some of these systems, you know, some of these just ethical and religious systems that were in place and ethical norms that were in place have just kind of dwindled as people have, you know, demanded. There's been, you know, again, customer desire for, I want to get my package as soon as possible. I want, you know, I don't want to wait a Sunday. I don't want to have to, you know, I want to be able to do everything that I can, you know, every day of the week and not just 6 days of the week. I think there's, you know, we're trying to reckon with a lot of this loss and a lot of this, you know, these changes and you know, degrading of the system. But we're kind of like grasping around in the dark because we don't have, we don't have people or principles to tell us clearly no. You know, a lot of the things that do exist, even like the laws that exist, like there's, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of laws now. And so a lot of them just seem so arbitrary. And so it just, the temptation is to believe that everything, you know, just truth is arbitrary. You know, if we just get, and all truth is just getting people, you know, is convincing, it's the democratization of truth. You know, it's just truth is whatever we can convince a large 51% of the population to believe. Yeah, I just think a lot of these things we are losing the ability because of beliefs that we've taken in to kind of provide or any kind of resistance, real resistance to some of the, again, the social media in particular, the things that are going on there.
Yeah, and I think that is the nature of the problem. It's like we have these false beliefs and technological things accelerate the endpoints. He mentions at some point, I was trying to find it, I can't find it, but he does say at one point, like, let's not blame corporate misincentives for the situation we find ourselves in.
Yes.
Like,
yep.
Yes. Like, advertising has all kinds of malincentives, but if advertising was entirely cut out of the picture, we would have in many ways the same sort of situation that we have.
Yep.
You know, Noster in the early days, for me, the focus was on the disintermediation of the platforms and the advertising malincentives, which lead to the censorship, right?
Yeah.
But you cut that stuff out. I think Noster is meaningfully decentralized, and that's very exciting. But at the same time, we still have feeds. And like to bring it back to that really quick,
yep.
A couple of things he says about feeds. The feed removed human deliberation and judgment from the process. It replaced personal agency with machine agency. And, you know, that machine agency is not ultimate agency. It's delegated agency. So is that agency delegated by the company, or is it delegated by yourself? And how much fidelity is there in that delegation? Those are all questions. You know, talking with Pablo in the last episode, he was saying, you know, only God sees global. There is no such thing as not having an algorithm, whatever that algorithm might be.
Yep.
But it's really important when choosing an algorithm to choose one that actually reflects our values rather than just gives our agency away cheaply. But at the same time, the feed has some inherent problems in it. And we were talking about that as well. Like what is the feed, the dark pattern of? And the reason the feed is so bad, Carr says, is everything is given the same semantic weight, which was no weight. Everything had the same semantic context, which was no context. Social media renders category errors obsolete because it renders categories obsolete. All information belongs to a single category. It's all content, and it pours through a single channel with a single objective, maximizing engagement. And so I think that really clarifies for me what a feed actually is. A feed is a funnel, and it, you know, it fits that trough metaphor again. Yeah. Like, it's just indiscriminately being pumped into our faces. Like, you know, it's just hot dog gloop, which is, you know, all kinds
of Skittles. It's like, do you hear about the cattle that were being fed Skittles?
No.
Oh yeah. It's like there's these big industrial farms where they just were feeding these cows Skittles and like a whole bunch of just random garbage. And they're just, cause it was cheap. They could get it. It would, you know, provide a certain amount of benefit.
And so what happens when we're fed undifferentiated content? Like, even if the content is high quality, like even if the algorithm feeds us the best of social media in whatever objective sense you might be able to discover. If it's not differentiated, then it's all misplaced, right?
I
can't remember, but there's some joke about how water is a thing that'll kill you, you know, if you have too much of it. You have to survive. Sorry, that was terribly told, but you know, you have to have water to survive, but too much of it is going to kill you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if my arm is fine where it is, but if it got attached to the back of my head, you know, that'd be context is important. Context shapes the meaning of any individual thing. And so,
what you're doing is you're articulating the fallacy of like the intrinsic value argument, right? Yeah, it's like, there's people who are like, this thing has intrinsic value. It's like, okay, water, it pretty much, you know, like obviously it's for if anything could be possibly considered an intrinsic value, you know, it would be something like that. Like it's an unquestioned good, except for you can still drown from drinking too much water. you can die from drinking too much of it. So yeah, context really matters.
Yeah. And so in concrete terms, you know, if you're doing something in public that you would normally do at home, that's a misplaced thing. If you're doing something in public or at home that you would normally do in public, you know, like obviously the bedroom has closed doors and closed windows for a reason. And you wouldn't like take a sign that you would take to a protest and put it in your living room. That makes no sense at all. And so the fact that everyone's consuming all of this content that people produce in this undifferentiated feed means that the producing of the content becomes undifferentiated. People are holding protest signs in their living rooms or in their cars.
Yeah.
So politics has come into the home and the home has gone out into the public square.
Mm.
And this isn't really like a point that Carr makes, but it does seem that the feed being the medium through which our lives are viewed and us being conscious of that everything that we do is being tailored to this undifferentiated feed, you know, it encourages us to do things that are more engaging because we want attention. But engagement and attention is not what any of these individual things are actually intended for.
Yep.
You know, articles are intended to stimulate thought and potentially action. Videos are meant to be videos of your kids or something are meant to be stored and remembered and shared with grandparents. Like there is a ton of differentiation. And I think like people recognize this with the move from globalized social media to, you know, private chat groups and stuff like that, where it's like, these are the people, this is the place, this is the time, this is the topic. These are all ways of slicing that feed back into pieces. And, you know, having been fed a feed, now we have hot dogs instead of steaks. But it is at least some kind of a reaction to the feed.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, what do you want to, we were going over the feed chapter. Is there anything else from that one that you want to get into?
Well, I wanted to touch on the antipodes stuff. You know, he talks a little bit about how this undifferentiated sort of mass of content it causes people to have a dislike preference. We already talked about that, but he also points out that healthy human relations, whether at the personal or the social level, require communication, but they also require boundary systems that curb the flow and intensity of communication. Let's see. Technology's bias is evident in the language that surrounds it. The internet from the start has been celebrated as a model of and a force for openness. An open network built on open standards and open to all. The net is, we are regularly reminded, the enemy of everything closed and secret. The rhetoric is rousing, but it should give us pause. A decent society will safeguard personal privacy at least as vigorously as it promotes self-expression. Transparency needs to be tempered by opacity. So, you know, the lowering of friction has to be tempered by friction as well.
Yep.
And this is like a huge takeaway for me is near the end of the book, he talks about frictional design, I think is what he called it. The boldest, most creative of social medias would be reformers. A small group of legal scholars and other academics have a more radical plan. They call it frictional design. They believe the existing technological system needs to be dismantled and rebuilt in a more humanistic form, pursuing an approach reminiscent of the machine-breaking strategy of the 19th century British Luddites, which I always compare myself to, so I'm right there with them. They seek to sabotage existing social media platforms by reintroducing friction into their operations, throwing virtual sand into the virtual works. But then he goes on to describe in the next paragraph how they're approaching it from a legal sort of point of view, which is disappointing because I got excited. I was like, oh, these are my people. Like, let's introduce friction into the overly efficient mechanisms. But he also has an answer to that, which I was happy to hear, which is that it's kind of too late to legislate. Changing policy now is going to undermine, you know, a multi-billion-dollar industry and make it more difficult to enter into the industry to actually disrupt it and fix it. So it's like, yeah, hands off. This system is what it is, and we should figure out how to take the next step, not try to fix our mistakes retroactively. So I appreciated that.
So he's basically advocating Noster. Congratulations, Nicholas Carr. We're glad to have you on the team.
I think he is. It was so sad to me. There was one point where he talked about how Elon Musk banned mention of competing platforms like Mastodon.
Substack and Mastodon. I was like, oh,
and I was like, no, what about the third one? The most important one. So he's read the word Noster, but it didn't register. It didn't seem important enough for him to include it in his book, sadly. So that's where it's at.
Yeah. I'm going to reach out to him again. He didn't respond the first time. I just, you know, shot him a reply to one of his tweets. So I'm going to try to see if we can get him on here. Would love to get his evaluation of Noster.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Yeah.
So should we kind of hit the last couple chapters here and see if we can wrap up? I feel like we hit most of the main themes of the book. He has a chapter on AI, which I don't know, just it's not that interesting to me. It's important, but it's not really the topic I'm super interested in.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, what else do we want to get into?
There's a lot. I'm trying to review a little
bit. We've kind of talked a lot about the democratization fallacy already.
Yeah.
Trying to think. Yeah, everything is mediated. Do you want to get into, we can spend, let's see, how long have we been going? About an hour. You want to do, let's get into the machines who speak. Is that the one you want to spend time getting into that one?
That's the AI tech. That's the AI.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But he does make a really interesting point in that chapter about myth. Marshall McLuhan said, when man is overwhelmed by information, he resorts to myth. Myth is inclusive, time-saving, and fast. This book is beautiful. It is really well put together because he introduces this concept in the middle of the AI topic, but then it actually is a pivotal thing that he comes back to at the very end of the book. Mm-hmm. Where myth is actually our way out of all of this, despite it also being a emergent problem of the democratization of media, right?
Yeah.
If we democratize, we start to categorize and we create abstractions, and those create stories that we want to believe in, regardless of the factual backing of them. But if we return to reality, we can actually look at reality and we can trust reality. I'll go ahead and introduce it. At the end of the book, he ends with Dr. Johnson's Rock, and that's Samuel Johnson. And he was discussing a theory by George Berkeley about the idea that nothing exists unless it's seen. To be is to be perceived. And after talking it back and forth, Johnson gets mad about it and kicks a rock and says, I refute it thus. And he's basically saying, you know, whatever nifty tautological sort of theories about epistemology you might come up with, the fact is I kicked a rock and it hurts. So, you know, Berkeley's theory is irrefutable. But the fact is the real world is much richer than his theory can account for.
Yeah.
And so if we can look at the world and believe in the myth, the story, the emotional attachment of the world as it presents itself to us, that's actually a way out of the self-made solipsistic sort of cyclical self-destructive false reality that we've gotten ourselves stuck into.
Yeah, can unpack the word myth here. What is he talking about? Because there's like a popular level usage of the word myth, and then there's the way that you know Lewis uses it, and they're not the same. Why don't you unpack some of that?
Right. Yeah. A lot of the time, myth is just considered a story that's false. But the way he says it, he says myths are works of art. They provide a way of understanding the world that appeals not to reason, but to emotion, not to the conscious mind, but to the subconscious one. And I don't know if I would say emotion is the primary way that it appeals to us, but a myth creates a framework in which we can exist. Right. It is essentially a story, and it's not a reductive story. It's an expansive story. Mm-hmm. If indeed there, we have winter because Proserpina is in the underworld 6 months out of the year, mm-hmm. then it means certain things about the world, and it enriches the cycle of harvest and winter with additional meaning. So myth gives us meaning. And enriches the boring material world, because the material world on itself, with no meaning, with no myth, is pointless. Carl Sagan.
Yeah, matter is negative, or matter is what is the, what's the, oh, gosh, the philosophy of that. What says that matter is bad? What's the
Gnosticism.
Gnosticism. There you go. Like he talks about myth, and he talks about it's on, I think it's in the fourth or fifth chapter. He says, talking about American myths, that is of the frontier. We were given a virgin territory, a space of pure possibility. It's like, that's like this framework that Americans, it's one of the frameworks that Americans have. It's like this romanticized view of who we are and why we're here.
He also says that that's not true. Like we never have a virgin land that we come into it. Like we have to build ourselves around the geography that's actually there. We have to build our society and our movement around the contours of technology as well. So
yes,
myths are not always true.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So then he quotes McLuhan, who said, McLuhan said he resorts to myth. Myth is inclusive, time saving, and fast. So it's like this thing that you just revert to kind of help you as a reference point to help you. Again, it's just like remembering who you are, remembering where you're going. It's basically, he's like just comparing. He's saying like, this is, everyone has myth. You know, we all revert to them. There's some that are more useful than others. And so this is kind of where, I would love to kind of get a more, I would love to read a book from him, more fully expanding on this idea and what he.
Yeah, and I feel like there's sort of two kinds of myth, because this is actually central to the naming of the book. The Super Bloom, it was this event that happened in California a number of years ago, where someone took some pictures of a big bloom of poppies in the mountains, and then everyone on the internet flooded to that place, trampled all the poppies, and destroyed them. Yeah. Just so they could participate in the super bloom. But what they wanted to be there for was not primarily the natural beauty. It was the social contagion of the hashtag super bloom experience.
Yeah.
And so we create this myth, and he draws from another writer. I can't remember who calls it hyper reality. And hyper just means, hyper comes from the word Uber, or it's related to the word Uber, I think, which means above. So hyper reality is this constructed higher dimensional reality that actually subsumes all sub realities into itself. And so in a way, through participating in these social constructs of like social media experiences and super blooms and memes and stuff, we're lifting ourselves into this hyper reality, which is more stimulating, more validating, more efficient. But the cost is that it alienates us from the material world.
Beauregard
Yeah,
is the guy's name.
probably pronouncing it wrong, but and he, you know, he compares this vision with Marc Andreessen's vision of online worlds that make life and work and love more wonderful for everyone, no matter what level of reality deprivation they find themselves in.
Yeah.
Marc Andreessen says, this is in 2021, that inequality will never end. There will always be privation, and there will always be the rich. So the best thing that we can do is shove all the poor into a virtual world with reality technology.
So disgusting. Yeah. I heard this.
He says,
let me read one thing. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah. No, you go ahead.
I'm looking at the part where it's talking about the hyperreal. I'll just read this one part because it's right in line with what you're saying. It says the real world can't compete. Compared with the programmed delights of the virtual, it feels dull, slow, and poignantly enough lifeless. By filling every moment with novelty and exaggerating every psychic sensation, the hyperreal, as Baudrillard argued, comes to feel more real than the real. It's the excess of reality that puts an end to reality. The video game designer Jane McGonigal, anticipating Andreessen's case for virtual reality superiority, argued in her 2011 book Reality is Broken that when we choose a virtual existence over a material one, we're acting rationally and in our best interest. And this is like the quote from the book. The real world just doesn't offer up as easily the carefully designed pleasures, the thrilling challenges, and the powerful social bonding afforded by virtual environments. Reality doesn't motivate us as effectively. Reality isn't engineered to maximize our potential. Reality wasn't designed from the bottom up to make us happy.
She's right. Except for the maximizing our potential part and the making us happy part is what Carr then comments, which I thought was exactly right.
But again, so I do want to think about this and from like, okay, so what is like the Christian answer to this, right? Because like, so the Christian answer is, I mean, it's not the same thing. It's not escapism, but like we are like, what do we do? You know, if you're a Christian suffering, you know, in India, you know, like you're being persecuted by these. I've got a buddy who, you know, lives and ministers there, and he's, you know, has been beaten a bunch of times, and you know, by these radical Hindu nationalists. Like, what is your response to that? Like, what do you do? And like, part of it is like you hope in, you know, in the fact that God, who's going to make all things right, is going to come one day, and so
like. Yeah. But not despite the physical world, like through or because of it. And this is the same answer that Carr gives. He says, like, we have to be okay with engaging with boring old reality, because it's only through the physical material world that we can reach transcendence. You have to be confronted with the shortcomings of this world in order to know what truth, beauty, and goodness are.
Yes.
Those things don't exist in a virtual world of our own making, because we have created something. I said before that the hyper reality lifts us up into it, but really it consumes everything and creates a smaller reality within the physical world. It is nested inside the physical world, even if it feels more amenable to our desires. And so it actually cuts us off from what makes art possible. And we talked about this in that State of the Union article a couple weeks ago, how, you know, entertainment eats art, distraction eats entertainment, and addiction eats distraction.
Yeah,
that's the same thing. That's this hyper reality that we've immersed ourselves in.
Yeah.
There's so much fascinating stuff in here that I would love to just like read the entire last two chapters. But one thing that he talks about is Baudrillard dismissed Marxism as an antiquated theory tied to the world of materiality, where the manufacture of physical goods was central not only to the economy, but also to people's lives and self-conceptions. In the new media-centered world we were entering, a world defined not by production, but by communication, not by objects, but by images, representations of things take precedence over the things themselves. Everything is mediated. We become, whether we realize it or not, simulated beings experiencing simulated events in a simulated environment. And that's kind of the definition of hyper-reality. And then there's also like a good bit where he says what we're trying to say about the super bloom, but more clearly. So I think this is central enough to the book to just read it. He says, when super bloom becomes hashtag super bloom, the experience changes. The media representation turns into a gathering spot, a communal, if entirely virtual space. And that's what people see and are drawn to. As more people attach themselves to the representation, its magnetic force strengthens. Still more are pulled in. The real thing, the referent, disappears. The carpet of poppies is experienced as an image even before it's photographed. To those who arrived in Walker Canyon intent on placing themselves in the frame of hashtag Superbloom, virtual reality had already displaced material reality. The canyon didn't exist except as content, content they wanted to become part of.
Mm.
And I think this is a really powerful idea that there is this metaphysical virtual reality. We don't need to put on Mark Andreessen's goggles in order to be sucked into this different way of thinking about the world in abstractions and in inclusion of our not real selves, but abstracted selves. But at the same time, that can't, well, I don't know, maybe it can exist without reference. But the existence of the hashtag Superbloom doesn't negate the existence of the Superbloom. It just hides it from us. And so, you know, I wonder to what extent we can participate in the hyper reality without being alienated from the actual reality, right?
Yeah. You know,
like, is there, are the two mutually exclusive, and the hyper reality is necessarily erosive of our access to transcendence through physical reality? Is there an actual trade-off for every moment that we spend in the hyper reality, or are the two complementary in some way? Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, pardon me. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, part of me wonders, is it a matter of what? Yeah, it's a matter of what you're doing there. Like, why? Like, your motivation for being there. Because, like, obviously, like, you can. Yeah, it's like, it's the difference between, like, orienting the thing around you, right? Like if that's the problem. Like, when you start to look at the world as if you're the main character and everything else revolves around you, you know, and, like, you can't just enjoy something for, you know, not even for its own sake. Well, like, I guess, yeah, you can't enjoy something for its own sake. You look at it as a tool to be levered towards this other end of exalting yourself or, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
like, it's just an exhausting
mentalism.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a whole weird. So are you familiar with who David Dobrik is?
No.
David Dobrik is like, was this really famous YouTuber from like 2016, 2017 until like probably 3 or 4 years ago. And again, he's funny guy, whatever, like did these YouTube videos where like it's him and his friends are all hanging out, but like they just turned their entire lives into like semi-scripted content. And so like, so it's like a TV show, but I mean, his friends are, you know, are the characters. And like it, so there's this one character, his name is Jason, who he's got kids. He's like divorced. His wife basically kicked him out of their home. And he just basically like gloms on to David, who's this, you know, who's wealthy. He's got this YouTube channel with like 25 million subscribers, whatever. And so like his whole thing, and he's like, they're good friends, but it's like this weird dynamic where like everyone realizes that like Jason is like a leech who just like needs David. And then he's just like talking about himself and the whole thing that's so disgusting about it. Like there's obviously things that are hilarious that happen, but the whole thing that's disgusting about this whole thing is like, it's all of these people who are using, like in a specific example of Jason, he's like, his kids are appearing in videos. He's talking about like his family and it's this whole, so it's so perverse. He's turned his kids and his failed marriage and all this kind of stuff into content that is, and it's like humorous content. So he's like making fun of, and it's this whole thing. You're like, this is so perverse in terms of like what you're doing. You're joking about this. You're mocking, you're doing all these things in order to get yourself views in money. And it's just such a perversity of, of what this is. He's, you know, he's talking about how he loves his kids. And then he's like, you know, screw my kids. You know, at one point it's all this kind of stuff. It's exactly this kind of thing. You're like, it's this radical individualistic taking of things that are otherwise good and healthy and right, and then like twisting them so that you're at the center, and then you're like sacrificing these things in order, you know, to exalt yourself and make money. And again, it's like you're denominating success. You're taking these beautiful, you know, divinely ordained and designed things and like, you know, twisting them and using them to denominate, to help you basically accumulate this this other currency that you that you're trying to, which is clout in monetary gain. And so, yeah, I think that's kind of what's being described there.
Yeah. And it's very difficult to sort out because, you know, it's not just that, like, we should fetishize the physical world. That's not it at all.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And in a strange way, doing that leads to this hyper reality because you can't escape metaphysics. Metaphysics is going to be there to explain and give meaning, like he's saying with myth. But the hyper reality is more of a myth than a space. Like, it's this alternate metaphysics to the one that actually does exist and gets you in contact with God and with truth, beauty, and goodness, which are defined by the character and person of God. And when we create our own metaphysics, we're creating a metaphysics with truth, beauty, and goodness, but they are in the reflection of our own untrammeled desires. So, you know, truth becomes identity, beauty becomes stimulation, and goodness becomes virtue signaling. And so we end up with this false metaphysics. And so if we're interacting digitally within this hyper reality, we're operating within a different set of values from the one that God created. Now, at the same time, there's much that happens in the digital world that does conform to the true metaphysics. You know, you can read an article that inspires you to think true, beautiful, and good, objectively good thoughts. And so, you know, pursuing the true metaphysics through the medium that has created this alternate metaphysics is actually legitimate. But I do think that given that the medium is not, the medium has created this alternate metaphysics, but it's not that it can't be reused in a proper way. The problem though is entering into that alternate myth, and that alternate myth is entirely mutually exclusive with the true myth of creation, of God himself being incarnated in the person of Jesus.
Yeah.
And this alternate myth is antithetical to real meaning because it offers its counterfeit meaning.
Yeah.
And this is actually something, this is the thing in the AI chapter that I liked most, is he makes the point at one point that the machines only learn by imitation, and so they have no real experience of the world. The next step in artificial intelligence development is going to be to allow AI to be embodied so that it can have a high fidelity sensory apparatus that allows it to apprehend the world in order to learn from it. And I think that's very true. And it also, it's incarnation. That's what that means, is the mind becomes meat. And yes, the AI is going to be more metal than meat, but this is what God did. But God did it differently. He wasn't a disembodied mind only able to access derivative truth. He's actually the source of truth. And when he becomes embodied in the person of Jesus, his higher metaphysics is then revealed to us in a medium that we understand. And so we now have a path to God through the physical world, to transcendence, to that true metaphysic, rather than our counterfeit one. And so I guess the question remains, that if we allow the AI to become embodied in the real world, that means we're allowing these false minds that are the product of our false metaphysic to get closer to the true metaphysic. Like, could machines come to know God through the experience of the physical world by being embodied in it? I don't know. Very strange question.
Who was talking about this? It was Jordan Peterson. I was listening to, it was Jonathan Peugeot talking about Jordan Peterson. And apparently Jordan Peterson believes that basically AI could sufficiently synthesize, you know, like, it can look at, you give it all this raw data about, you know, religion and about, you know, just the nature of reality. And like, it'll come to the conclusion that Christianity is true or something. And then like they're gonna, so it's like you're gonna have revival among AIs. And then he's saying like that would actually help humans then. And it's just this whole weird thing of like, again, it presents the fundamental barrier to humans believing in God as if it's only informational. And it's just like, no, dude, this is not how this works. This is, again, yeah. It's a fundamentally different anthropology of like what you're accounting right now.
Yeah, and it's extremely perverse to set these AIs, which are entirely the product of statistical analysis of our own misguided thoughts, to be an oracle of truth.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
And even like, you know, introducing AI to embodiment to the real world is maybe interesting in one way. At the same time, that's literally the fashioning of an idol. We have created these oracles that we look to be true. And we say, well, they're not doing a good enough job because of this limitation. So in order to give them access to truth, we're going to introduce them to God. Well, what's the point of that? Just like, I don't know, like, look at God directly. He presented himself to us. That's the medium that he chose.
And again, like it's completely derivative, right? Because like, I mean, the logic, and it's like, I would argue like satanic. It's like in God's economy, there's God, and then he creates us in our image. And then what we're doing is we're basically doing the same thing, but setting ourselves as gods. And then we have like, okay, now we're going to have the embodied, you know, it's not incarnational, whatever, in mechanical or something like that, whatever, in mechanization or something. I don't know what it would be, because it's not flesh that they're taking on. They're taking on, you know, whatever it is. But yeah, well, the other thing it reminds me of is Jonathan, another thing with, there's an interview with this guy, Ruslan. He's like a Christian who has like a YouTube channel with like a bunch of subscribers. He had on Jonathan Peugeot, who's this Eastern Orthodox thinker and YouTuber and brilliant guy. But they were talking about like the role of the saints. And basically they say like the Eastern Orthodox thing is basically like, you have these saints and they achieve, you know, they're examples. They, you know, live these lives of like exemplary faith. And they basically try to make this argument of like, where do you deny that? Where you don't have like these certain saints who are like elevated and look to the way that like the book of Hebrews, you know, chooses out some particular names and like elevates their faithfulness. They basically said like, where you try to get rid of that, like you don't actually get rid of it. You just replace them. And so they talked about like what do we have? What's the modern secular equivalent? It's like, we have stars, you know, you have like, again, we even call them like, you know, these sons of God, like these are higher elevation humans. You know, these are effectively demigods. And so somebody like, you know, like the Kardashians or, you know, whatever, like it really does kind of function this way of, you know, you end up like, yeah, you end up with these people for whatever reason who get elevated and made, you know, as if these are like the embodiment of the best of humanity, you know. And the more you have things that distort that reality, again, like fiat currency is one of these things. You know, it basically totally distorts who gets lifted up, because it distorts who and how you get wealthy and how, you know, and who gets built, what kind of things succeed, what kind of businesses grow and succeed. So yeah, I just think it's really, you know, fascinating to look at and to like try to look at things through that lens. Yeah, I don't know. There's like 100 things we could talk about. But anything else before we close here? We've been going for about an hour and a half.
Yeah, let me just read a couple quotes from the last couple pages. Hopefully this doesn't irritate Nicholas Carr by stealing the thunder at the very end of the book. But Johnson's Rock. He kind of brings that home at the end of the book. He says that Johnson's act of kicking the rock was an expression of humility. He was saying, my mind is not the thing that is going to dictate reality. Reality dictates the shape of my mind. This rock is actually an imposition upon me, and I can't ignore it if I want to be intellectually honest. Let's see. He also talks about, you know, quotes Brooks and says, the world is its own best model. It is always exactly up to date. It always contains every detail there is to be known. The trick is to sense it appropriately and often enough. So, you know, being online is not necessarily a bad thing if you're sensing fidelity, high fidelity information about the world that then conforms you to reality. It's just that the digital world necessarily has to mediate the physical world in order to communicate it. But then, you know, a lot of the time that is useful. Science is data about the physical world that you wouldn't be able to get by just going for a walk in the woods. So both kinds of knowledge are probably valuable. Let's see. There's just a brilliant paragraph here. He says, despite our love of, or at least infatuation with, the easy stimulations of the virtual, we can never make a home there, at least not without sacrificing the qualities of sense and sensibility that make us most ourselves. Live in a simulation long enough and you begin to think and talk like a chatbot. Your thoughts and words become the outputs of a prediction algorithm. To argue for a more material and less virtual existence is not to make a case for materialism alone. A hyper-reality is all surface and no depth. Beyond the simulation lies nothing at all. Any attempt to transcend reality intellectually, artistically, or spiritually has to begin from within reality. You can only get beyond the material by going through the material, by suffering and surmounting its frictions. And that becomes harder and harder to accomplish or even to imagine the more that life is mediated by mechanisms of communication.
Yeah, I would love to talk to Nicholas Carr. Would love to hear like his you know, religious view of the world. Would love that.
And the, you know, the endorsement of Noster is definitely not explicit, but the very last sentence of the book is, if you don't live by your own code, you'll live by another's.
Yeah,
that's a very interesting way to end this whole thing, where he's encouraging people to be in touch with reality.
Yeah.
What does reality have to do with your own code? It's a very, very strange way to end the whole thing. I mean, I do agree, like, running your own code, whether you're talking about your own internal view of the world and understanding of the world, or actual code that you wrote to be an agent in the world, in the digital world, in either case, you're exercising skill and agency in order to be shaped according to virtue, and to shape the world according to your understanding of virtue. And I think that's the ideal that the democratization fallacy really wants, is it wants diversity. It wants every little thing and every individual personality that has insight into the world or value to be recognized and cultivated. The unfortunate side effect is, by instrumentalizing that, you destroy all that individuality. But it's not destroyed if you live as an individual rather than as an abstraction. And the difficult thing to swallow about that for me is that individuality does not scale. You cannot communicate your own personal internal experience with another person, even in the most intimate scenarios and situations, like in a marriage or in a family. The other person knows you better than anyone else. They may even know you better than you know yourself, but you can't like broadcast your specific insights to the entire world. I think it's similar to how Christians think about space. You know, space is huge. And
as in outer space, or what are we talking about here?
Outer space.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know, like it's kind of almost a truism to say that space is so big, God made it just because he delighted in it. We're not even supposed to see what's on a lot of the planets. And this is especially true if you're a young Earth creationist. It's like we only had 7,000 years or so to explore the entire universe. Of course, we're not going to get it done. God's going to roll up all of creation like a scroll, and all the exoplanets with crazy, strange life existing six galaxies over from us, we'll never see them. God made them. God ended them. He enjoyed them. And we don't know. We don't get to know. And I think that's true of every individual person. God gets to see our hearts. He gets to see who we are. And he allows us to share some of that with the people around us. But it cannot be digitized and uploaded to the cloud. And that's disappointing because we want to be infinite. We want to live forever. You know, he actually quotes John Dewey in here, and he said, John Dewey says, like, all the frothing activity that we do, it must be angled at filling some void within us that leaves us restless. And that just makes me think of Augustine. He said, you know, I want to be restless until I find my rest in God. And that's absolutely right. I mean, that's what transcendence is all about. That's what those transcendent virtues are all about. Those are the things that we actually crave. And we can't fill that hole, that void within us, by manufacturing our own transcendent virtues, because they're not transcendent.
Yeah. Or, like, again, you can, like, practically, you know, do this, but yeah, I just think, again, the world is made teleologically. The world exists, like, your life, you know, you have been given a certain number of days, a certain number of hours, a certain number of experiences. And like, the question is, again, we don't, what's the famous Lewis quote? We only have to decide what we do with the time given to us. Is that Tolkien?
That's Tolkien. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, we don't get to choose. Again, this, we talked about this, I think, before, just like the reality that, like, anything of consequence in your life, you did not choose. Like, the most consequential elements of your life, you didn't choose. You didn't choose when to be born, where, to who, you know, what's your body, you know, any of these things. Like, you don't choose any of them. And so, like, if that is true of all of the most inconsequential things about you, like, shouldn't we take from that maybe we weren't created only to glory in ourselves? Like, maybe we weren't created primarily to, you know, maybe we don't exist primarily to, you know, exalt our own selves and to live primarily thinking about and orienting the rest of existence around ourselves. There's something bigger going on there, and you can either fight against that your whole life, or you can submit to that. And again, I think that's a big part of, I mean, the scriptures talk about this, you know, like, will you be a steward, or will you be a rival king? You know, and again, Tolkien, you know, unpacks this a lot. Like, this is Denethor, you know, you know, basically he's been entrusted, he's the steward of Gondor until the time comes where the rightful king returns. And then Gandalf comes to him and tells him the rightful king's returning. And he goes, no, I won't give it up. And, like, in that moment, like, he is embodying sinful humanity. Like, this is the question. Like, will you lay down, you know, and pursue the rightful rule of the, you know, of the real king, or will you continue to try to suppress that reality in order to exalt yourself? And again, that one, like, you can make your choice, but you don't get to choose your consequences. And so I think that, you know, this is part of, and again, you can try to choose whatever you want, but it's not just going to have ill effects on you, although it will. It's also going to have, you know, secondary and tertiary effects on everyone, you know, on the entire world. And so, again, this is why I think we can acknowledge the power. I mean, God's going to require of rulers, they're going to give greater account. Like, this is just the reality. God gives rulers, they have more authority, they have more, you know, their lives have more consequence, and they need to take that seriously. But at the same time, we don't minimize our own responsibility. You know, like, there can be rulers who make their lives of their citizens more difficult. They can make it more difficult to do the things that we ought to do anyhow. But again, it's not a total excuse on the part of those of us who are here, those of us who aren't rulers, to just say, well, you know, the king or Trump told me to do this, or whoever, you know, told me to do this, and so I couldn't help but do it. You know, it's like, these two things are in tension, and they work together, and we need to be good stewards as individuals, and insofar as we can, as, you know, within, whether it's our families or whether it's our churches or whatever, you know.
Yeah, and I think the idea of stewardship is super important, because, and it is so hard, because you can't just choose one or the other. You can't choose to be inert, or to exercise agency. Those are both heresies. You have to choose to respond to the things that you've been given faithfully. And, you know, there's the, in the political world, there's, like, the blood and soil, like, conservative right. And then there's the liberal progressive left. And the liberal progressive left wants to make everything in our own image. The conservative right wants everything to be the way that it is, as if is a justification for what ought to be. Yeah. It's like, no, we actually do need to have a vision for what we need to do, but we also have to look at what's been given to us, not only the power that's been given to us, but the blessings that have been given to us, the grace, the things that we don't deserve, that we haven't actually created by our own hands, and respond to that goodness by then doing things. It's not a comfortable position to be in, because it asks so much of us, and yet it also declares our complete inability to do anything on our own. We are nothing. We have not created our own selves. Like the Bible talks about this. Anyone who says that he's a self-made man, is telling a lie. It's just not the case.
I mean, again, we could literally spend a lot more time on these things. We actually ought to do, John, we actually ought to do like a proper book club where we actually invite listeners to actually, you know, read some of these books with us. That actually might be a fun way. So if that's interesting to you, shoot us a DM on Noster. Let's think about doing that, because I really do think it'd be fun, it'd be interesting to if people are interested, shoot us a message and we'll
chat. Great. Even.
John, any little sneak peek of future episodes? What do you got coming down the pike in the next few weeks?
Future episodes? Well, I've got a conversation with someone. I won't give it away, but they have built in the past, they built a app for communities. So they've done a lot of thinking about that. So we're gonna talk in a couple of weeks here, hopefully. And my goal is that I get a little bit more insight on how to build something like Flotilla, again, in a way that supports communities rather than disintegrating them. So that's something you can look forward to. Other than that, let's see. I've got a whole bunch of books. There was actually one at the end of Super Bloom that he mentioned.
Oh, really? Okay.
That sounded really good. I want to talk to the Humane Tech folks as well. Jonathan Haidt and the Frictional Design folks.
Yeah.
I don't know if that'll turn into podcast material, but
you're saying you want to read those books.
I don't know if they have books, but they have websites, and they're mostly like intellectuals at Yale and Harvard and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I don't really. I think that we can get Haidt. I think I've got some people who are connected to him where we might be able to get him on the pod. Yeah, it'd be worth reading one of his books first before we did that. But yeah.
Yeah. No, I bought The Anxious Generation, so that might be showing up here pretty soon too.
Okay.
But that was a great go ahead.
Dude, what is your September look like? We're getting a little behind the curtain stuff. Do you have plans for September at this point?
September doesn't exist for me. That's
okay.
That's in the distant, distant future.
Okay.
I may not even be alive.
Okay.
I'll be old by then, I think.
Yeah. Woe to the one who says, you know, in the future we will go and trade, and you know, so yeah, we'll just that'll win for now.
Just shows you how good I am at planning things. I don't know what I'm doing on Monday.
All right. Well, John, appreciate you, man. Again, to everybody else, for all of our listeners, thank you so much for the support. Again, one big thing that you can do for us to support the podcast, the reality, we'll get you again behind the curtain. The reality is the most influential person in the podcast game is Apple. And so even if you're not listening to this, and again, we love people who are listening to this on Fountain and other places where you can, where you can stream it on Noster even. Again, the reality is that for us to find and to get this content in front of the maximum number of people, it's the reality is that Apple is the place to go. So if you have an Apple device and you find this content valuable and you'd be willing to take literally 3 minutes to go over there, subscribe, even if you don't use the Apple Podcast app, go over there and subscribe and leave us a review. That would be a huge help. It would be a massive help. That would help Apple basically signal to them that, you know, this is good content. So we'd really appreciate that. And again, similar thing, if your app of choice is Spotify, you know, the evil centralized worlds of Apple and Spotify. Again, that's another place where you can support us even without money by just going over there and doing that. Those would be a big help to us. So
yeah, as the resident Luddite, I'm going to throw some sand in Jordan's gears and just tell you all, just zap us and don't leave any reviews on Apple or Spotify.
Yes, you can zap us on Noster, the Thank God for Noster. Actually, speaking of this, we didn't announce this, but the Thank God for Noster Noster profile is now in better hands. John, do you want to expand on that?
I've been given the private key, so I can now publish. So I can now neglect the profile, just like Jordan has established the long tradition of doing.
It's so true. It's way too true. I've got too many profiles going on, so I, you know, gave it over to John. So
yeah,
hopefully, yeah, we'll
probably to the Coracle one anymore. So yeah, but I'll try.
All right. Well, we appreciate you guys, and we will see you on Noster.
Yep. And I'm gonna go outside and touch grass. It's a beautiful day in the physical world.
All right. We'll see you on Noster. Yeah. Appreciate you.
Noster.
Noster.